I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folker.
Welcome to Talking Biotech, the weekly podcast where we discuss breakthroughs in medicine and crop biology and other aspects where biotechnology solutions can help solve problems for people and the planet. My name is Kevin Folta. I do this podcast every week. And this week we have an opportunity to meet with a couple of speakers today. But one of our people we'll talk to is going to serve as a guest host. And he's one of the first people who's actually done the job of saying, hey, I know somebody cool I'd like to talk to. Could we do it on the podcast? So I'd like to welcome from University of Missouri, Nat Graham. How's it going, Nat?
Good. How are you?
Okay. So you're at University of Missouri, and I guess I should mention that we did meet maybe back in March.
Yeah, I think it was around March.
Yeah, and I was actually visiting the campus, and you were very kind to, you know, kind of take me around and everything. But could you tell me a little bit about what your job is there and why you study what you study?
Yeah, so I'm a graduate student. I'm a researcher in the Department of Biology. I work in a lab with Dr. Jim Birchler, and so we work on different methods to improve how transgenic technology works. Specifically, we work on how you can add transgenes to, in our case, corn, without interfering with the rest of the genes that are already in the plant.
Yeah, so I see why that's important, because you're not disrupting any of the normal function. What his lab is famous for is this idea of like mini chromosomes, like adding an extra gene or two or cassette of genes onto an extra whole new chromosome that's then inherited stably. Is that the right thought?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So we work on corn, and for whatever reason, there's a couple of different types of corn that have an extra chromosome that we call the B chromosome. And it's kind of inert. It doesn't really do anything. It's just there. So because it doesn't have any genes on it that you could interfere with, and it's separate from the rest of the genome, it's a perfect way for us to target new traits right onto that extra chromosome, which we call the mini chromosome then.
That's pretty cool. Does it work in humans?
You know, I don't know. I have no idea.
I could use a few more traits.
Right.
I know it's, anyway, I could go into a million routes on that one, but we'll just leave it there. So what's your experience as a graduate student in biology? I know it's more and more, fewer students are heading that direction, especially domestic ones. What led you to be a student in biology, and how have you found the experience so far?
Yeah, so I like biology a lot. I got into it because I was not really sure what I wanted to do with my life. And so I ended up doing some different things and taking some classes. I went to Truman State University. It's a little school in North Missouri. And I saw a lecture on food security there where they talked about, you know, we're going to have 10 billion people by 2050, but we don't have enough space. We don't have enough food to feed them all. It's this big problem. And so that kind of got me energized into, well, we've got all this cool technology. Is there a way we can use all of that to help solve these different problems? And so that's kind of what got me into the field. And so then I started looking around at graduate schools and things, and I found the lab that I'm in now, which is doing right up the alley of figuring out how to make our technology work for us.
Yeah, you really can't get much better than University of Missouri for that kind of for those applications in grains, especially. And folks like Jim Birchler, as good as he get you, as good as you can get in terms of innovative, cutting edge science. And so, what's next for you in your career?
I'm not sure. I'm kind of open to anything. I'd like to. I'm kind of liking getting into the communication side of things. I'm starting up a project here with communication, but I'm kind of open to anything at this point. I've probably got a year left, so I'm kind of starting to seek out see what's out there.
Well, that's really cool. So you can use this opportunity as your curriculum vitae, your audio CV. Well, tell me more about this communication program that you're starting.
There's a lot of different ways you can do outreach at University of Missouri, but when I started looking into it, I realized a lot of the opportunities are really targeted towards kids. And you go to elementary schools, middle schools. I've done some of that. It's actually kind of cool. I took like 100 kids through a day, and we did genomic extractions of strawberries, and they can get all the DNA out. That's really cool. You can see them get all excited. But in my mind, we don't target the adults a lot. And those are the people who are voting, and those are the people who are telling their kids really what they should believe too. And so I wanted to figure out a way we could do a program where you can kind of target the adults in town. And so we're starting up a program called Science on Tap. There's a few of them around the country where I have graduate students two a month that will come in and talk about what it is that they do at a bar in a pretty relaxed setting to anyone in the community who's interested in coming out and finding out what they do.
And that's a really great idea. I think that I would encourage any graduate students to do this kind of thing, not just because it's an important aspect of how we can share our science with a community. And a community that understands what you're doing is a much better community than one that is looking at the work at universities as adversarial, which comes up a lot. But this is also a good thing for you as a graduate student to be kind of demonstrating leadership and coming up with ways that you can define your niche that makes you unique from the other 1,000 postdocs that will apply for those positions.
Yeah, it's kind of been exciting to see how excited other graduate students are about the opportunity. I was kind of worried about, can I get enough speakers to do it? It's only once a month, but it's really, can I get enough people? And I've been really surprised. Within the first week, I filled up the first semester, and people are pretty excited to go out and kind of spread what they do.
Well, that's extremely cool, and especially because it's good practice for people who will eventually be on the job market to learn more tricks about how we can better prepare our science for a public audience, and not just talking to our peers, but talking to the people who are the decision makers in our communities, who, as you mentioned, who are voters, who are helping to construct local policy. And for every one person we can touch and we can help understand what technology can do for food and farming, that message helps resonate. So this is a very good use of your time, and super glad you're doing that.
No, thanks. It's going to be fun.
So tell me about today's guest and maybe how you came across him and what some of the general aspects of his particular program.
Yeah, so we have a weekly seminar here for people who work on plants that will come in from around the country and talk about what they do. And I just happened to go to Dr. Gooden's seminar. He's talking about how coffee is really important in the world and how there's this virus that's affecting it. And I had never heard a thing about it. I mean, I'm pretty active in figuring out how, you know, genetic modification can help and the different plant diseases that are out there. And I'd never heard about the severity and just how bad the virus potentially could impact the economy of the world. And he was really well-spoken, and I thought the work he was doing was really cool, and he had an idea of how biotechnology could help solve that kind of a problem that's affecting a lot of different countries around the world.
And coffee also tends to be affecting a lot of countries in the developing world, so coming up with solutions that can help this highly valued crop really can bail out local and regional economies.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I don't drink coffee myself, but I see a lot of people who do, and I keep thinking, man, that's a lot of money that's exchanging hands that's kind of at risk for a virus that no one's really heard about.
Wow, you don't know what you're missing. It's this wonderful feeling of awakeness, like all of a sudden it's like driving in a fog, and then you drink that cup of coffee, and it's like stepping out of the Kansas farmhouse into the land of Oz. it's a wonderful experience for me every morning, and I'm enjoying my probably fourth or fifth cup already today. So I'm excited to talk to him. And what's really interesting about coffee, and we had someone on recently from World Coffee Research, was Hannah Neuschwander, co-hosted by Hannah Neuschwander. Go back to episode, I think, 30 if you want to review that. But what is fun to reinforce was the idea that coffee comes from a plant. And many people fail to realize that, and that these plants still have the same vulnerabilities and sensitivities that all of our agricultural crops do. And that we really are just one virus away from perpetual fogginess and walking in the walls. I mean, it is very, if we had something happen in coffee like is happening in banana or happening in citrus, where there are these unstoppable diseases, we could be in for a long haul here. And so, Nat, let me see if we can get Michael to join us here. Michael, are you there?
I am here.
Yeah, so that's really great. So from Lexington, Kentucky, we welcome Dr. Michael Gooden, who is associate professor in the Department of Plant Pathology at University of Kentucky. So welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
So could you tell us a little bit, just to kind of start the ball rolling, about what you do in the university capacity and the, kind of the scope of your research?
With pleasure. So, associate professor in plant pathology in the Department of Plant Pathology. And my focus is on primarily negative strand RNA viruses of plants, plant rhabdoviruses in particular. In the genus that replicates, the nuclear rhabdovirus genus, they replicate in nuclei of infected cells. They're a very interesting group of viruses. They're plant viruses, but they're related genetically to things like rabies and Ebola and Borne disease virus. And so from a cell biology perspective, they're quite fascinating. And there are a number of these that are agriculturally important. And actually, that's that experience that's what has brought me into this coffee project, because the virus we've been focused on, coffee ring spot virus, is what's called a dichora virus. It's a relatively new genus of emerging viruses, and they are essentially a rhabdovirus cut into two pieces. Their genome is split into two RNA segments, whereas the rhabdoviruses are a single segment of RNA that makes up the genome. So, this whole sort of coffee project and working in Brazil is basically all driven because of the type of viruses associated with this emerging disease.
That's really cool. So it's split in two. Is that like an evolutionary artifact of the way that viruses are transmitted from cell to cell and integrated? Is this just like two parts of it that then, as both parts are expressed, they combine to make a potent virus?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. So, and it's been a bit of a taxonomic nightmare to try to organize where these new viruses go. So, things like rabies and Ebola, and the nuclear rhabdoviruses have six or seven genes. The largest being the polymerase, and the dichora viruses, which are most closely related to the nuclear rhabdoviruses. All of these viruses replicate in nuclei of infected cells. The dichora virus has taken the polymerase and put it on a separate RNA. So you've got two RNA segments instead of one. RNA 1 has five genes in it, and RNA 2 has a single codes just for the polymerase. Why would the virus do this? I think there's some interesting biological questions. So coffee is very genetically homogeneous. There's very little genetic variation in the coffee bean grown commercially. And then these are mite-transmitted viruses, Brevipalpus species. And these are fascinating from a sort of ecology, biology standpoint. The populations exist as haploid females. They basically are symbiotic with a species of bacterium called Cardinium species. That maintains the populations as haploid females, and they propagate clonally. And so there's very little genetic variation or chance for genetic variation in the mite population. And so if you're a virus, what do? Your opportunities for recombination are reduced, I think, in this type of atmosphere. So if you split your genome, at least you have opportunities to reassort RNA segments. So something like flu, influenza, okay, has multiple RNA segments, and that's why flu is such a such a battle continuously, because it has excellent opportunity not only for recombination, intermolecular switching, but just trading segments. Right, so mixing of segments to make new strains, so that reassortment allows for greater genetic mixing, and it's interesting to think that maybe the Dicora viruses had to do that, given the genetic constraints in their plant hosts and in their vector. Yeah, that's. Yeah.
Okay, so let me just clarify really quick for those who are listening. When we talk about the DNA polymerase, that's the enzyme that actually synthesizes additional nucleic acids, so additional genetic material from the virus as it replicates. But and also viruses have either RNA or DNA as their genetic material, depending right. upon the type of virus. And one just quick question is, how does this virus, if it's an RNA virus in the nucleus, how does it translate the protein? So how do you take that information from RNA and create the proteins that make it functional, which are out in the cytosol?
Okay, excellent. Great question. So I like to say that these viruses are a little more human than other viruses. And what do I mean by that? They are what we call negative strand RNA viruses. So if you purify the virus and extract the genomic RNA and were to try to translate it directly, you would not make biologically relevant proteins. So that genomic RNA is actually the template, and it's the copies of that template that's going to make the messenger RNAs. So the genomic RNA is encapsulated over its entire length by a protein called a nucleocapsid protein. You can think of this as like in a human cell, the DNA is associated with histones. So you have a ribonucleoprotein complex. And then the virus, when it infects a cell, actually carries with it the polymerase already made as a protein associated with this nucleocapsid. And so basically what you've got is the transcriptional machinery is the infectious unit, and it enters the cell, and what it does, the first thing it does, it uses that genomic RNA as a template to then start to make the complementary copies of it, which generate the viral messenger RNAs, which get translated. So it goes to the nucleus, transcribed, those messenger RNAs are exported to the cytoplasm, and translated. Humans, you transcribe the DNA to make messenger RNA, gets translated to make the proteins. So a lot of other viruses actually are plus strand RNA. So you can take the RNA out of the virus, and its first job is to uncoat and be translated and generate the polymerase is its first step. But the negative strand RNA viruses, like coffee ring spot virus, like flu, come in template ready, to make messenger RNAs, transcription ready to make messenger RNAs.
Getting into how the viruses that you're talking about affect coffee, so just to kind of bring back, how important is coffee to the world and to the economies?
Let's just pick two reasons for importance. Okay, so there's an economic importance. Obviously, coffee is second only to oil in terms of value of traded commodities. So there's oil and there's coffee. Natural gas and gold are the four top traded commodities in the world. So as an economic driver, for some countries, coffee is 70% of GDP. Yeah. Coffee can only be produced in a very narrow band in countries around the equator, primarily about 5 degrees north and south of the equator is this coffee belt around the world. Brazilian coffee is 40% of the world's supply. And so it's exceedingly important in that country. But let's look at the importance of coffee as a as its cultural relevance. And so I have an analogy that derives from organic chemistry. So all organic chemistry reactions take place in a solvent, right? The reactions take place within a solvent. So if you think about coffee, when do you drink it, right? So it's that first date. It's that, hey, you know, we have to have a talk conversation. It's that graduate student and mentor designing new experiment. Hey, let's go have a sit in a cafe, design things. It's with your friends. There's a huge social interaction that is driven, okay, through the coffee culture, right? That those conversations. I like to say that coffee is the solvent for the human condition for a great many cultures in the world, right?
I like to think of it as the stuff that keeps my heart beating.
It's that.
No, if I stop drinking coffee, it gets down like in the low 30s and I get dizzy. And no, I definitely need to keep a steady state of caffeine present.
Yeah, so you mentioned that 40% of the world's coffee is produced in Brazil. So is that kind of where the virus is also prevalent?
Yeah, so correct. So most of the work, practically all the work on coffee rainforest virus has been done in Brazil. It was first discovered there in 1936. It's not considered a major pathogen for a very long time. There is one report of coffee rainspot in Costa Rica, and we don't have data from other countries. Other countries, they're primarily fighting coffee rust, which is a fungal disease, as their major. Coffee borer is an insect pest that's very important. And these tend to sort of fly over the radar of the virus problem, which is minor compared to some of these other fungal diseases. In Brazil, even though the virus was discovered in 1936 and now considered a very long time, about in the last decade, just anecdotally, there have been increasing reports of the prevalence of this virus. And why is that so? And we've seen this worldwide with things like cassava brown streak and tomato yellow leaf curl and a number of TOSPO viruses, where, viruses that were once, if not benign, not a major deal, all of a sudden now become a major issue. And we call these emerging viruses, and there have been a number, particularly in the last decade, 15 years or so. Is that linked to climate change? It's paralleled, and one would sort of hypothesize that there's a link in changing climate conditions. So we did a survey in 2014, 2015, Basically, just to ask the question, where is this virus? Because it's only been really studied in small pockets. And we did a survey over about 75% of the coffee-growing region in Brazil, and we found it on 100% of the farms that we visited. And so it seems to be everywhere. It is the mite vector is a dry weather pest. And so if it's hot and dry, you get higher mite populations. Higher populations means a higher prevalence of the virus as well. And so that's probably been the major driver. Prior to this year, so California and Brazil experienced that very long 5-6 year drought period. And within this period, there was a really large increase in the amount of ring spot virus prevalence.
And so is that also is the case for the mite also located throughout the what you call the coffee belt?
Right. So there's you can't uncouple these two things. Where there's mite, there's virus. And the symptoms of the virus disease show up about 2 or 3 weeks after mite infestation. And that's something we'd really like to look at. We've looked at the population structure of the virus. We'd like to look at the population structure of the mites and see how these correlate. Where it's been examined, all of these type of viruses replicate in their arthropod or insect vector. And so we believe that, you know, as the mite expands its range, so does the virus. And why do I say there's this inextricable link? Well, in coffee, this ring spot disease, you get a ring spot that's basically initiated at the site of feeding of the mite. And then that leaf, that infected leaf, will defoliate. And so that's sort of the problem of this virus in coffee is the defoliation that it causes, which then exposes the cherries to secondary infections and sun scalding in particular, which could reduce quality. So that's the coffee in Brazil is plantation grown, open. There's no shade canopy. In the wild, coffee is a understory tree, kind of like dogwood in Eastern North America forests, right? So you've got to have canopy trees over these understory trees. But in Brazil, the plantations are just too big. Production is just too big. So they use these very bushy varieties. And so the leaves are important to provide that shade that the cherries need to mature properly and to produce high-quality coffee. So if you get a lot of defoliation, then that's a problem.
So that's a really good start to talking about the symptom spectrum that we see with this particular disease. We'll take a break right now, and then we'll be back in just a few minutes with more of Dr. Michael Gooden, who's an associate professor at University of Kentucky, talking about the coffee ring spot virus that's a problem in Brazil, but also other parts of the world. We'll be back in a few minutes with some more Talking Biotech.
Grandma, don't touch that radio. Hi, Talking Biotechers, this is Vern Blazek, the Vern Blazek Science Power Hour, and booth announcer for the Talking Biotech podcast. We're moving into our 40-somethingth episode, and we get lots of requests for an interview with Dr. Folta himself. What makes that dude tick? How is that cat wired? We'll explore the deep crevasses of his soul in Talking Biotech episode number 50. So, you might recall that I interviewed him on my podcast, the Vern Blazek Science Power Hour, with your host, Vern Blazek. it was considered by some a raging case of non-transparency by those who wanted to cash a check with a manufactured scandal. It was so much not a story that we're going to do it again, only using your questions. If you have a question you'd like me to ask Dr. Folta, send it to my attention at talkingbiotechpodcast@gmail.com. I'll assemble all of the questions and grill that turkey with my interview for episode 50. He's a scientist, he's a thespian, and I'm a hard-hitting booth announcer that's glad to ask the hard questions. Let me know what you'd like to know. And now back to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
And welcome back to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Again, discussing this wonderful liquid called coffee. But more importantly, reminding everybody that this comes from a plant. And this incredibly valuable commodity that most of us enjoy every single day, it's probably the one plant item that everybody consumes. Well, not everybody. There's a few out there who have yet to discover the magic, but that many people consume on a daily basis. And so we're here today with Dr. Michael Gooden from the University of Kentucky. He's an associate professor there who works on a coffee virus. We're also joined by co-host Nat Graham, who is a graduate student at University of Missouri, who studies mini chromosomes and how you can move genes around in maize. And Nat was kind enough to identify Dr. Gooden as an outstanding candidate for a guest here. And please make your suggestions, too. It would be great to hear who you would like to hear from as well. So back to the conversation. We were talking before the break about the symptom spectrum associated with the virus. And how wide has this spread? And where do we find this where do we find this on the planet?
So, excellent question. And something that's a real active area of research and should be expanded. Brazil is the major center of focus. There is one report from Costa Rica, as I said, and we don't know if this virus is in other countries at any significant prevalence. And I have colleagues in Indonesia say that are scouting for it. So one of the things we found, speaking of scouting, when we were in Brazil, is that the early symptoms of coffee ring spot virus looked like the start of a rust pustule, and so because rust is so important, the major disease that everyone is focused on, people often mistake the virus symptoms for when you're learning to scout for this disease. It takes you a little while to be able to differentiate between the true virus symptoms and the rust symptoms. Once you find the differential, then it's easy, and you can find the virus everywhere. So in terms of world spread, we actually do not have these data, but because Brazil is 40% of world population, and we know so little about this virus, we're really just centered there at the moment to learn all we can before really expanding these studies globally. But I don't want to give the impression that this is impending doom for coffee or anything like this. This is viruses emerge, you know, there's still going to be coffee in your cup tomorrow.
Well, that's good news, because I've been stockpiling in the event that I have an underground Patriot safe full of small arms and coffee to guarantee my continued sustenance. I guess the other question would be then, how is it managed inside Brazil? Is it really a production question that there are ways to use insect or miticides to control the vector, or how is it controlled?
Right. So this is, and probably leading up to your biotech questions, virus control, you cannot cure a plant virus infection at present, right? The control of the virus means control of the mite. And at present, some of these miticides are, they're quite toxic. And so they have to be used judiciously and with oversight. So there's not residuals in the coffee. And so this is one of the major problems. If we could find a way to reduce sort of the chemical impact, because the miticides, one, they're expensive, and two, there are residue issues that are of concern. And so the other thing is, the world coffee prices. I just looked it up. So a kilogram of Brazilian green coffee bean is being traded in the commodity markets for $3.40 a kilogram. And so if you think about just coffee, how it's grown, where it's grown, all the inputs that go into, producing this, and then you've got to sell it for $3.40 a kilogram. When prices are this low, a lot of farmers will not have things like weed control, because that's also expensive. And one of the things that we're looking into is, how does coffee, we know that coffee ring spot virus is capable of infecting weed species, amaranth and Chenopodium and things like this, that are cosmopolitan weeds. And so if you have poor weed control because of low prices or whatever, does that raise the reservoir of the virus in the wild? And the other thing that is really quite fascinating, certainly from a molecular biology, plant biology standpoint, is that there does seem to be, for some plants, Chenopodium being one, an increased susceptibility to this virus as the temperature increases, and modest increases, 2 to 4 degrees, which is why this virus is very interesting from the standpoint of climate change, because 2 to 4 degrees is, right in the prediction window for global climate change, certainly by 2050 projections. And so if increased temperatures increases plant susceptibility to this virus, will this virus spread to other crops? Will it spread into weeds and raise the reservoir? If that happens, then there's a greater rate of transmission to coffee, right? It's quite complex. It's more than just controlling the virus on coffee. One is now concerned about, how do we manage the reservoirs in the weedy population under conditions where coffee prices are low and the export beans are low. So this is the challenge.
Do you know if there's any biotech solutions that are being researched, or has there anything been done in that sector to kind of combat the mites?
Genetic engineering of coffee is still extremely difficult. To be able to regenerate a coffee plant from callus is still very difficult. So biotech solutions really need to overcome this hurdle first, to have a consistent and somewhat facile way of making transgenic coffee. So we have since it's an RNA virus, we have technologies probably very efficient, similar to how papaya ring spot virus is protected or zucchini is protected against viruses in the United States using transgenic methods. Yeah. So the technology you would deploy has been worked out a long time ago, is very efficacious. Getting it into a transgenic coffee plant is is a major technical hurdle right now, simply due to the ability to transform and regenerate coffee. So it'll be a while before that happens. The other question is the world ready for transgenic coffee? Would you drink transgenic coffee? And this is a really, you know, interesting question. And would you prefer to drink transgenic coffee over coffee that's been treated with chemicals? Okay, which do you see as more environmentally benign or healthier or anything like this? And I think this is still very much an open conversation, particularly given the export markets, you know, in Europe or Japan or other countries, or even the U.S., where GMOs are still a contentious issue. But for overall control, I think we're going to have integrated approaches, because with climate change, projections are things like coffee borer will get more severe. Coffee rust has certainly been incredibly severe the last few years, and we're getting emerging things like coffee ring spot virus. So it's not just that the virus problems are emerging. There is at least a trilogy of issues at the insect, fungal, and viral levels that's making coffee growing very difficult. And then just the climate itself. We've already seen effects of coffee plants that are flowering multiple times a year simply due to the climatic changes that, you know, are beyond the norm.
Well, there's all of this, and then the improved vectoring of humans around the planet. When transportation allows us to move quickly, you can not only spread the virus, but you can also spread the plants. You can move mites Correct. Around. So this is another contributing factor. And the other interesting thing about the biotechnology side is people will shun this idea. Like you say, would you rather eat something with you know, either the chemical or the transgenic or the genetically engineered version? And probably the most clinically dangerous part of coffee is the caffeine itself, which has been is a carcinogen. It's a known carcinogen. Of course, you know, you probably have to abuse it like I do, but its risk in all of its shows again our lack of understanding of what risk is. Caffeine is made by coffee plants to protect it from insects, you know, in its right. most basic form. So we are drinking and enjoying a natural insecticide. So it is weird how people don't really understand what risk is and what are the components of coffee that could potentially contribute or save the crop.
Right. But I think, you know, within that... that's difficulty, or there's great opportunities. Coffee is, I'm thinking about designing a course for like Gen Ed or something like this, built around coffee. I think you can teach everything in coffee. There's chemistry to be learned. There is fair trade. There's economics. There's the sociology of coffee, just the poetry and the cultural aspects to it, and I think once you start to integrate the various components, then questions of, you know, what do we do, how does biotech fit into all of that, because biotech has to fit into all of that. There are for some people, coffee is their livelihood, okay, and if you're growing organic coffee and you cannot ever use chemical control and you get hit with coffee rust, okay, that is your livelihood, okay, and how do you protect those communities? And it's somewhat can be easy for us sort of on this side of the world to make these judgment calls, which in some part of the world are basically life and death decisions, to spray or to not spray, to either try to protect your crop or protect your organic certification or things like this. These are quite complex socioeconomic issues, under the present technologies, and we will, going forward, impose upon that then a biotech contribution to the entire coffee story. And so I think it's a rich area for discussion and debate. One should not, sort of be rushed to say we will not do X, Y, or Z without considering the various facets of all what goes into to coffee production. Yeah.
So I'm sure you've had the debate a little bit, but have you figured anything out about what the feeling is from the farmers or the consumers about how this debate might go?
So what I found in Brazil, and I really should, and actually all the coffee places I've been to, but I spent the most time in Brazil, is just a remarkable acceptance and willingness to work with folks in academia and to partner to protect their crop and produce the best possible crop. One of the really sort of interesting, if I can sort of give an anecdote, since the way we collected, the way we collected a lot of our material was simply, driving around in the coffee growing regions and just stopping and then walking onto farms and really not getting permission beforehand. This is sort of a unique, this is my first time doing things like that. Here, one would upfront get permission from farmers and stuff like that. And this one particular day, it was near the end of the day, and I was kind of uncomfortable. It was early on in our survey, and I was a little uncomfortable with just walking onto people's farm and, touching their plants and grabbing material off their plants. And I was assured that it's okay, that this is how it's done here. And this pickup truck's come barreling down the road, and I thought, here we go. This is going to be a confrontation. Screeching of brakes, and this guy jumps out. Hey, what are you doing here? Why are you on my farm? And we explained that we were from the university and we're studying this disease. And it just flipped. And he said, well, we have to go to lunch. We come up to the house. Let's have a coffee. Let's discuss what you're doing. And then what became, 15 minutes of collecting leaves transformed into, a multiple hour discussion, and what can we do for you, and how can we help you, and how can the other farmers in this collective cooperative work with you on this. So from the farmer's standpoint, it's just phenomenal, overwhelming support, because it's their livelihood and their passion. Coffee drinking culture is quite passionate, but certainly coffee growing culture is equally or more so, because you get both. You get to see it grow, and you get to enjoy this, the coffee of your labor. So huge support on the farmer side. It's whether or not you can impose biotechnology into that and then get consumer support. So how will this consumer respond? It is an open and debatable question. But I think the more people, there's an evolution, let's call it that, in coffee, right? So this so-called third wave of coffee production, first wave being, coffee is just a source of caffeine to wake you up in the morning and keep you going in the afternoon. And the second wave with, Peet's and Starbucks, you started to get a regional, identification. This is Sumatran and this is Ethiopian Yirgacheffe, and you start to get that. Now this third wave, it's almost like wine, okay? There's these regional variations and, basically the GPS coordinates of the farm from the where your coffee is coming from is printed on the bag. And it's very intimate, knowledge. Just how you would treat wine varietals, say. And I think once that becomes more culturally ingrained and people take a real look at the communities of where the coffee in that bag that you're drinking from is coming from, then all these other biotech and social and economic issues will be more focused, because they'll have to pay attention to it if they're that involved in that bag of coffee that they're growing on. So I see this all as a learning and opportunity to integrate communities from around the world. It certainly will enhance geographic literacy, this third wave of coffee will, which is a really good thing.
Well, a lot of times in science, we find ourselves studying a given topic because it had some sort of cultural or, I don't know, other kinds of life or family relevance to us. Was there something that brought you to coffee in particular, Michael?
Indeed. So I was born in Jamaica, and it's a country and a culture with a rich coffee culture, very ingrained. And it's really centered on Blue Mountain coffee, which is one of the rarest and most expensive coffees in the world. So I've always had that as a background. And so that's sort of my rooting to coffee. And I've been to Indonesia and to work with coffee producers there, and then now in Brazil, and to see all these different variants. And what's interesting to me passionately is that coffees are very much like people, right? There's a lot of variation. It's all coffee, right? It's just like all people. But then each one individually is quite unique. And so this one's a little more acid. This one's a little more, it's got more fruit flavors, more chocolate, more caramel. And if you get to know coffees as people, then it's kind of, we kind of learn about each other. And for me, coffee culture is basically my sort of philosophy on, of people, sort of what's on the outside, what the label is on the outside of the bag, kind of doesn't matter. You've got to sit down with it and you've got to look at the nuance and the chemistry of it, as you consume it. And that takes time. And if you give yourself the opportunity to do that, you can travel around the world with coffee. It's literally, it's really quite fascinating.
And so if people wanted to learn more about your program or maybe follow you in social media, where would they look?
Yeah, so I do have a website, a college website, but I'm happy if they just email me directly, mgooden@uky.edu. I don't have a massive social media presence, but probably should. And from the Brazil standpoint, they can check the Inova Cafe. It's the coffee research center at UFLA, which is the university that I study. So it's Inovacafe. They have an excellent Facebook page with all things coffee. Those would be, some of the times the best thing to do is just go down to your local artisanal coffee, their place, and just talk to the barista there about the different varieties. And it's remarkable how quickly you'll be transported around the world, through coffees. So that'd be a great place to start.
Nat, where can I find more information about you on social media or about your Science on Tap series?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. I'm not 100% active yet, but I'm trying to get there. My Twitter is Nat, not Nat, it's a play on my name, but it's NatNotGnat. If you wanted to find out more, if you're in Middle Missouri and you wanted to check out one of the Science on Tap programs we have, on Facebook, we're Science on Tap Como. And on Twitter, we're SciOnTap_Como, so SCIONTAP _COMO. So you can find out more about that event that's going to go on through there.
Okay, very good. And I am now a follower. Just signed on and got you there. So very good. All right, well, thank you both very much for joining us on Talking Biotech. And yeah, keep me posted on any big developments. So thank you very much, Michael.
I will. Okay, and continue to enjoy your coffee. I'll send you a collection.
Awesome. Yeah, and thanks very much, Nat. We really appreciate you reaching out, and thank you very much, and best wishes on everything.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.